Good morning. Good evening, everybody. I apologize for being late. Hope everybody is well. Hope everybody had a good holiday. Okay, so tonight we are discussing Israel as a society, and asking some interesting sorts of Jewish, as well as kind of political and jurisprudential questions. So I think one place to begin is just a little bit of summary, which we talked about a few weeks ago, but I'll do it anyway, just because it sets things up in terms of this whole issue of the status quo and these conversations about who is a Jew. We'll be revisiting this in a few weeks also. A couple of things to remember. One is that if we go all the way back to Herzl, remember the three core themes that he thought about in Old New Land. One was, what would it mean to have a Jewish and democratic state? Right? The political question of what kind of state he wanted to build. The notion of it being Jewish and democratic was something that, as I said to you before, was something that I think itself begged a lot of questions. Not just the, well, could you pull it off? What would it mean to have a democracy in the 20th century? Not so clear about that. But also, you know, what do those terms really mean? Right? I mean, the United States called itself a democracy in 1902 when he published Alt Neuland. It had Jim Crow in the former Confederate States. It didn't have the 19th Amendment. Women couldn't vote. So in other words, the whole notion of, you know, what is a democracy? Who gets to define that? That was a kind of a, not just a philosophical, but a practical, political, administrative question that was very much alive, certainly in the turn of the century. And that was going to be relevant in a kind of a Palestinian Jewish state as well, right? What's a democracy? And of course, the question of Jewish and democratic, what's going to be Jewish about it? The third question I pose, the second, of course, great theme in the novel, which is not so relevant here, is the kind of the communitarian question, which was, what kind of economic social system was it going to have? Was it going to be capitalist? Was it going to be socialist? What were going to be the values undergirding it? Was it going to be things like equality and fairness, or things like innovation and competition, or freedom versus equality, to use sort of American terms? But the third one was the Jewish question. Remember the cultural question. What's going to be Jewish about Zionism? Is it going to be redemptive? Is it going to use religious language? Is it going to be about things like Mashiach? Is it going to be using Torah language? Is it going to be about observance, mitzvot, halakha? That also was not just a kind of a theoretical question. It was going to be a question that was going to filter down through institutions, into neighborhoods, into homes and the like. Can you, if you decide you want to open up a movie theater in your neighborhood, can it be open on a Friday night? That's a commercial question, but it's also obviously a religious question, a cultural question. What kind of neighborhood do you want to have? Do you want to have my you know, we were just in Israel, as you know, my wife, my daughter, doesn't matter. Somebody pointed out in the neighborhood that we were staying in, which is a quote unquote secular neighborhood, although lots of religious people living in it, they pointed out, oh, there are more cars here on Shabbat than there used to be when we lived here. I have no idea if that's true or not, but the point is, it was an observation they were making. Well, you know what, in some neighborhoods, people really object to that. Some neighborhoods, people couldn't care less, And some people, in some neighborhoods, people sort of notice, but it's not that big of a deal, because the social contract is not to make it a big deal. Right? So the question of what was going to be Jewish about the state was a kind of a live question. And of course, behind every philosophical question, there is always the political question, which is who gets to decide the question? Right? If you have a society where you don't have a 19th Amendment, it means women are not deciding anything in the public sector. Right? They're not citizens in the full sense of the term. If you have a society where you have people called rabbis, sages, masters of the text, who are claiming that, well, we shouldn't have, that the suffrage should not, in Palestinian Jewish society, prior to the establishment of the State of Israel, women shouldn't vote. Right? As I think I mentioned to you, or maybe not, my brother-in-law once said to me, who lives in Israel, that Israel should be governed by a bicameral legislation. Did I tell you that story? Where I almost had to whip out my Ativan and give myself a loading dose of about 5 at one time. He said, "Oh, Israel should be governed by a bicameral legislation of a Knesset and a Sanhedrin, kind of like an upper house, lower house, sort of a Senate House or a House of Lords, House of Commons kind of deal." So the point is that these are things that are both sort of extremely interesting on a kind of a theoretical, abstract, philosophical level, but ultimately it's really about who's in the kitchen, who's cooking the dinner, who's getting to decide these things. Right? The rabbis are not just theoreticians, quite to the contrary, they're politicians. They're very political figures. They want a lot of powers. They want the ones to decide about schools and about kashrut and about Shabbat, etc., etc., etc. So these are ultimately very political questions. So the final thing that I will say before we, you know, sort of jump into these different things is, of course, a very famous story that takes place sometime in the early 1950s. I don't really exactly remember when, but not so important, that you may have heard. Ben-Gurion had a very strong interest in these questions, partly because he fancied himself to be a Jewish thinker, and he was very interested in Jewish matters. He studied the Bible on a regular basis. He was very interested in sort of the history of the Jewish people. He certainly saw Israel in the context of that much larger drama, and he would frequently invoke that in terms of his speechings, his speeches and his writings. But also, again, practically, he recognized, look, you know what, the reason why we fought so hard to make this happen was because we wanted the opportunity to create the next chapter in Jewish life, but he also recognized that that begged the question, what would be Jewish about that next chapter? What would be Jewish about Israel, other than the fact that it would be a state for Jews? So, he went to see one of the great rabbinic sages who was living in the State of Israel, somebody named Avraham Karelitz, who lived in Bnei Brak. His rabbinic name was the Chazon Ish. He was a great Lithuanian sage. He'd come on Aliyah in the 1930s, but technically a non-Zionist, right? Lithuanian Talmudic Jewry, as it was understood, as it expressed itself in its formal kind of institutional way, was the Aguda Yisrael, which was a quote unquote a non-Zionist party. And Karelitz, the Chazon Ish, was really the kind of spiritual leader of that community, the halach leader of that community. And Ben Gurion went to see him. He paid a courtesy call on him, which is a very nice thing when you think about things like the Oval Office. The president doesn't go to see people typically. People come to the Oval Office. That's sort of the way we think about thing. So, you know, the issue of why the rabbi didn't come to him, that's interesting too. Anyway, so the Ben-Gurion goes to the Chazon Ish's home. The Bnei Brak is a kind of a neighborhood of Tel Aviv, metropolitan Tel Aviv. And with the intention of kind of beginning at some version of a kind of a conversation along the lines of what we're going to have tonight about things like the relations of church, religion, and state, and the like. So the Chazon Ish, in kind of classical rabbinic parlance, he, among other things, he says, well, let me tell you a story, or let me tell you a midrash, or a mashal, a kind of a parable. And he says, you know, when you have in a kind of a canal or some sort of narrow waterway, you have two boats. And one is carrying a lot of cargo. One is very heavy. It's laden with goods. And the other one is very light. It's empty, or it's not carrying many goods. Which one, and the passageway is narrow, which one should give way to the other? So, and what's the answer? What would you say the answer is? Those of you who are into boating, what's the answer? Which one should give way? The light one, right? That's kind of obvious. So the question is, all right, so, you know, what is this sort of weird little rabbinic mashal, this parable about? Which is the heavy boat? Huh? Well, how come? It's heavy with the Torah. It's carrying cargo. And what's the light one? The secularists. Right? They have the Tel Aviv Museum of Art, and they've got Treif hot dog stands on Gork Beach, and they go to the movies on Friday nights. Like, there's no Torah there. There's no cargo. It's Goyim Nachas. There's no substance in secular Zionism and Judaism. Secular Judaism, it's a kind of an oxymoron. So that was the Chazon Ish's way of saying, you know, we're in for a fight here. Right? We don't have a whole lot of power in the new state in political terms. Like, he wasn't an idiot. He got that. Like, he knew, you know, the prime minister is a guy who doesn't wear a yarmulke. So he recognized what the political reality was. But of course, he was making a deeper point, which is when you actually get around to hashing out this set of issues, this kind of basket full of stuff, you should defer to Torah Judaism. So I don't know whether or not Ben-Gurion left the Chazon Ish's house with a stomach ache or a headache or whatever, thinking, oh, God, I can't believe I got to deal with these people. Or he may have thought with much more, you know, sort of sanguinity, what do I care? I was a mensch. I went to pay a call on him. I almost said a shiva call, God forbid. But in some ways, that's sort of what it was. But the point is, he had to recognize on some level these people aren't messing around. You know, that they have a view of things that says, yes, the revolution has succeeded. Yes, you have built a state. Yes, we get the fact that you were the ones who mostly did it and we were sitting and not doing it. But we are not going to all of a sudden just kind of capitulate philosophically to your vision of what Judaism should be, what Jewish identity should be, and who should ultimately be running this thing along what lines. We have a philosophy and we have a worldview, and we have every intention of continuing to maintain that and hopefully for it to have some impact on the larger set of questions that Israel was confronting in 1948, 50, 52, etc., etc. And of course, those of you, I mean, we're all engaged in Israel in some fashion. So unless you've been living in a cave for the last 50 years, you recognize that not only did not those issues not go away, but in some ways they've become intensified, right? Separate seating on buses in certain communities, Haredim in the army, Right? Lots of interesting kinds of different scenarios to think about, to bring it up to the present. You'll do much more of that with Jacob. So that Chazonish, you know, Ben-Gurion little anecdote, I think really an interesting one about, you know, what the political stakes were going to be. So that's really what I wanted just to introduce to you tonight. And now I think we should jump into the text and the problems. But one final thing before we do that, which of course is, and I kind of alluded to this in the comment about whether or not it was a Shiva call. What was the argument for thinking that Ben-Gurion was doing that visit as a kind of a Shiva call? A Shiva call on whom? I mean, symbolically, if not really. Shiva call on whom? I mean, again, this is in the late 40s, early 50s. So in what way, I mean, it was sort of a kind of a cheap flippant remark on my part, but I shouldn't make because it's never appropriate when it comes to saying something about a Shiva call in such a lighthearted way. But a Shiva call on whom? Why would he be paying a Shiva call on the Chazon Ish, yeah? Yeah.
And so, you know,
he'd
pay his respects, but he didn't really think it would be any continuing issue.
Yeah, well, also, but of course, that's true, right? In other words, the whole question of religious Zionism, in terms of how significant that was as a force, was definitely a question, right? If you look back, and you can Google this, and it may actually be, I forget if it's, they have the table in Yehuda's book or in Anita's book. You know, if you look at the party representations, Knesset by Knesset, how large is religious Zionism? Because that's the question that you raised implicitly. How significant is religious Zionism as a political force? Anybody know? I mean, I'm not looking for exact numbers here.
Well, like after 67, it's really not significant at all, I don't think.
Well, and it becomes more significant, but numbers in the coalition, anybody have a sense of that? If they 48, let's do 48 to 67. Religious, the Mafdal.
10% of the coalition.
Yeah, okay, so not nothing.
No, but they're highly leveraged because they're the ones who allow the coalition to be born.
Well, yes, although the coalition is stronger than that. But it's interesting, I just said the Mafdal, right, the National Religious Party, what's called in English the NRP, which now, in effect, no longer exists, really. It's been sort of cannibalized by all these different things, Yisrael Beiteinu and these other things, but the Mafdal, the National Religious Party, was not politically insignificant. I think you're right about that. On the other hand, it was in the coalition. It was in the labor left of center coalition. Try to wrap your heads around that. Right now we would think of the religious parties as largely to the right of center. That doesn't mean they were leftist, but what it does mean is they wanted to have a share of the stakes, and they saw, obviously, prudentially, that meant being in the coalition.
I don't think it's a question of left-right, even today. I think it's more a question of they know what they want, and they know how to get it by playing along.
Yes, that's true.
And they figured out the game, which is something none of the other religious organizations within Israel have yet to figure out in 68 years.
Well, that's the definition that Harold Laswell, the great political scientist, offered. Politics is the study of who gets what, when, where, and how. Meaning, if you're interested in actually getting something, you got to figure out how to do that, and then you got to do it. Right, so that's the logic of being in the coalition, and that's true. There is a kind of a radically pragmatic quality to that, but it is also true, just to push back a little bit, that for example, in 67, the NRP, which was still in the coalition at that point, you know, we'll talk about this more when we get to 67, they were still dovish on taking territories. In other words, they followed the Labour Party line, as opposed to the Jabotinsky line. That wasn't their issue. right? Territorialism, the notion of a greater Israel, the kind of the Jabotinskyite view, the Likud view, the Chayrut view was not their view because all those years they'd been sitting inside the coalition. So the Maftal, the NRP, and the roots of the NRP were in what? Anybody remember? You did this probably a little bit last year. What were the roots of kind of religious Zionism?
Mizrahi.
Right, Mizrahi, which is a party that had been formed in Eastern Europe by people like Yitzhak Reinus, great Lithuanian rabbi. Most of his colleagues were non-Zionist, including people like Rabbi Soloveitchik's family. They were not members of Mizrahi at that point in time. Most Lithuanian rabbis were like the Chazon Ish. They were neutral / anti-Zionist. Okay, but the NRP was the formulation of the people who, by definition, broke with that and they supported Herzlian political Zionism. Okay, so the NRP was small, but it was not nothing. But the Chazon Ish, the Aguda, right, why is he, so he's not really paying a shiva call on the NRP because they are the ones who have in effect successfully transplanted themselves from Eastern Europe to Palestine. So who's he paying a shiva call on?
The 90% of the Jews who died in the Holocaust.
Yeah. Of whom, religiously speaking, what are we talking about?
Orthodox.
No, but I mean, numbers-wise, 3 million Polish Jews, another 1.5 million Jews in the Soviet Union.
Hungary.
Hungary, right? Can't forget the 400,000 Hungarian Jews, right? The pictures most of the pictures that we have from Auschwitz, right, 1944, the pictures of those people, mostly women and children on the platform in the summer of 1944, Elie Wiesel's family, other people. Most of those people were Orthodox, right? And they are non-Zionists. They are ultra-Orthodox. They are right-wing Orthodox. So those are the people that Ben-Gurion had a sense of, I'm paying a shiva call on them, right? 95% of Lithuanian Jewry is killed. 90% of Polish Jewry is killed. That is the heartland of world orthodoxy. The great yeshivas, the rebbeim, the rabbis, the schools, etc., etc. Most of those clans don't survive, although, of course, that's a very ugly story, too, that in the case of the Hasidic community, a lot of the rebbeim got out, the rabbis got out, and their followers didn't. The rabbis got out because they had followers in the diaspora who pulled strings, who got them out, couldn't get out their followers. And the reason why it's an ugly story is because in many cases the rabbis had told people, this is a little bit like the church today, you know, wherever the rabbi is, that's where you should be. So people didn't leave, then the rabbis get out. So there's a lot of bitterness in a lot of those communities about that fact. And that includes the Lubavitch community, by the way. There's a very interesting book about how the Lubavitch Rebbe got out of the Warsaw Ghetto in 1940, 41. So he's paying a shiva call at some level on those people because the people who got to places like Palestine were like a tiny remnant of this huge community that had been destroyed. Community of communities, really. So I think he has a sense that when it comes to global Jewry, not just demographically, but also sort of politically and spiritually and culturally, that he doesn't really have much to fear from ultra-Orthodoxy, from non-Zionist Orthodoxy, because they're not powerful enough. It's not fair to say they have been apolitical, because they had been political in Poland. Poland had a legislative body, the Sejm, S-E-J-M, and Orthodoxy had been politicized. They had kind of learned from the turn of the century on that, hey, you know what, we've got to get politically organized. We've got to be like the liberal assimilated Jews. We have to be like the Zionists. We have to get political. So it wasn't that worth, and then in fact, that's a very good way for you to think about what it meant to be a modern Jew in political terms. There were three political strategies in modern Jewish political life. One was integration. Who adopted that strategy? The Jews ought to be politically integrated. Who adopted that strategy?
Germany.
Who else?
Americans.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the dominant American Jewish political strategy. You integrate into the system. You become a citizen of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. You decide, hey, I want to support Congressman Kennedy. I want to get involved. I want to call him up on the telephone. I want to be involved in his campaign. I want to do the AIPAC thing, like, you know, whatever. The point is that fundamentally is about integrationist political strategy. It also presumes the state will allow you to do that, which, thank God, is the case in the United States. But it's also the case in Germany, in Weimar, etc., etc. It's also the case in interwar Poland. Poland is a very weird place that way. On the one hand, there's all kinds of political, social problems Jews are having before the war. On the other hand, they do have this independent kind of streak that includes some degree of constitutionalism. So even Orthodoxy participating in that. So that's political strategy number one, which is integration. Political strategy number two, obviously, is sovereignty. And who's the poster child for that? Yeah, that's Zionism. Says, you know, hey, integration is not going to work. We have to go for sovereignty. And then the third, at some level, is really Orthodoxy. How does Orthodoxy represent a third rail here?
They stay within their own community and run their own community.
Okay. Which goes back to what you alluded to, which is they're looking for certain things from the larger society so they can do their own sort of intra-communal thing. And again, we don't really recognize that from here because in a liberal state that doesn't happen, right? In other words, the Orthodox community is not really doing that within the larger sort of Commonwealth of Massachusetts political frame.
It does in certain places in New York.
Yes.
Yes.
There are certain communities.
Right? That's the Kiryas Yoel thing, et cetera, et cetera. Right. But that's a part of the backstory to what we're talking about tonight because part of the question was going to be for somebody like the Chazon Ish, to what extent we can continue to do that in Palestine. In other words, was there going to be one political system, one educational system, one Jewish identity system? Who's going to run that? And in some ways, that's exactly the right way to see it. Thank you for mentioning that, Carol. Because what it really meant, therefore, is that when he goes to the Chazon Ish's house, at some level, he is engaging in a conversation that is this going to be a politics of sovereignty or is it going to be a politics of sovereignty plus this Orthodox add-on piece? And what's that, therefore, going to look like? But again, his sanguinity index, when he goes, is pretty high because that community is pretty weak. Not particularly well organized, not wealthy.
He misjudged procreation.
Well, that's right. That's the whole trend line thing around demographics and the like. But that's the backstory. Okay? The Holocaust is a huge piece of that backstory for sure. Demographically and otherwise. Okay. So, I talked enough. Now, what are the issues? I gave you the backstory. What are the issues in these, as you saw these texts and the like? And we should spend the most time with the ones from the Jewish political tradition because those are the primary sources. But what are the issues? We should list them on the board. Yeah.
They did have some leverage, trying to gain more leverage than Lubitsch discredit the Ben-Gurion and the Zionists, or and even sort of oppose the vote. So they're sort of getting their left wing, and what can they control in the new state? What sort of powers could they have in the new government?
Okay, so one issue is suffrage. Right? You see, am I paraphrasing you incorrectly? Who's going to get the vote?
Who's going to get the vote? And you know, what control? What
right? What
agencies? What structures
yeah.
do they have control?
What do we call that? Well, I'm thinking of another term, but I can't remember what it is now. Yeah, agencies, and then I'll think of the term.
Institutions within the government?
You know, sort of perquisites. Okay. Right, what will they get to control? What else? Yeah?
That there would be anything like a constitution that might supersede their religious views.
Great. The whole issue of a constitution.
The government structure even before you get to constitution.
Okay.
whose law? The Torah law, or would it be other secular law?
Yeah.
And in what type of law would control over what issue?
Absolutely, that's huge. The whole legal piece is absolutely central to this. Yeah.
Education.
So, meaning?
Meaning. Is everyone subject to the same education system, or is their religious education on an equal par, an equal footing?
Right. Is there going to be one system, or is there going to be a system of systems? Of course, we know how that turned out. But what else? Yeah?
Military-related things. Who will be serving the army? How will it be done? Will it be integrated?
Right, draft, etc. Yeah. What else?
Religious observance. And practice.
Yeah, observance, practice.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean we'll get to that in a couple of weeks, but that is certainly there because it also goes back, you know, it goes back to this one.
And conversion.
Yeah, conversion, etc. Yeah, identity. Right. What else? Anything else? I mean these are I think a lot of the biggies. Yeah.
Holidays and days of rest.
Right. You know, national calendars there. Absolutely. That hooks into observance for sure. You know, Shabbat, etc., etc. Yeah. Anything else? Okay, so where should we start?
Start with the agreement that Ben-Gurion made.
Okay, the status quo?
Status quo.
All right. Well, you know what? I want to pull rank. I don't want to start there. How are we doing on time? All right, because I want to spend maybe up to the break. We'll try to get to there by the break. The first couple of texts. I mean, one of the things to bear in mind, if you looked at the first couple of texts in the Walzer, you know, the authority thing, the primary sources. What struck you about those first few texts where they're kind of talking about, you know, these are kind of rabbi people talking about Jewish you know, sort of jurisprudential kinds of questions. What struck you about those texts vis-a-vis the larger project of Zionism? Anything strike you about those? Yeah, Eva?
They were very much looking backwards for precedents.
Fabulous. Why do they do that? Why are these texts looking backwards? I mean, we got a few lawyers in the room, right? Huh? Any lawyers? Okay, I'm going to take a picture of you and send it into the next edition of Ripley's Believe It or Not. Room full of Jews, well-educated people, nice suburban people, no lawyers. Oh, there are lawyers? Ah, you're just shameful, shame-faced ones. Okay. All right. Well, that's terrible. You gotta wear your colors, right? I was just in Cambridge, England, at the university, so you have to wear your colors. So, No wigs. I would wear my gown without being appropriate. So what is the jurisprudential thing around why are they looking backwards all the time? Well, but is it just like a rhetorical move? Like what's that about?
Yeah. In the secular world, but certainly in the Talmudic world, people are always citing precedents.
Absolutely. You have canonical texts. You have scripture. You have a Torah-based civilization. And so you always want to be hooking contemporary problems and / solutions back to classical sources. That's where you garner your legitimacy by being able to do that. Now, there's a lot of cynicism. I mean, this is part of the whole, you know, those of you who took Meir or study Talmud, you know this. The question, for example, inside of the canonical system is, I think, the very interesting jurisprudential one, which is rabbinic law basically manipulating biblical law for its own purposes, which would suggest that the rabbinic law really trumps biblical law in some fundamental way? Or is biblical law really generating rabbinic law? That's a really interesting question. I frankly think it's completely obvious that it's the former and not the latter. But the point is, that's an argument. Like, that's a really interesting question in Jewish cultural, religious history, intellectual history. But even if you don't feel the need to kind of adjudicate that dispute and settle it with finality, the point is, you're always looking back to the past. You always want to say, you probably did when you remember if you studied. Remember when you studied the precursors in Herzberg, those early rabbi people, Kalish or Alkali, when they would give a talk about returning the land, it would read like a Devar Torah. They would hook it back to a verse in Tanakh somewhere, the Bible. Yeah. The way the rabbinic figures thought.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they weren't even there contributing to the building of the state. So now they show up. Oh, here's what we're doing.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
So really, I thought that was very interesting about what the sample is. Really, like, well, the halakha had for all these years been built based on what it didn't, you know, what it could cover, but so many issues were being covered by the non-Jewish world.
Right, and the,
because the way it evolved was in a certain court, and now this is a whole new world.
Yeah, well, that right. So that it's that's such a wonderful insight that he has, and thank you for bringing that to us, because that was really the flip side of what Eva just said, which is that what these guys are strong on is this kind of intratextual conversation about what a polity should look like and who should do what, right? What they're weak on is, but they've never run a state. They've run a kehillah. It's not that they haven't had a politics, right? That was the Zionist sort of overreach. The Zionist overreach was saying, well, the long, dark night of diaspora living, of living in dispersion, was we never had a politics, right? From 70 all the way up to now, Jews have just been sitting in yeshiva, you know, like eating grapes in the hummus and studying these absurd questions, and there's no politics. That wasn't true. Jewish communities always govern themselves. They had lots of politics. They had courts, right, torts, criminal, commercial, right, civil, right? They were doing lots of politics, but they didn't have the full Monty, right? They weren't governing themselves in the full sense of the term. And therefore, what it seems to me, I mean, we'll look more closely at these right now. Therefore, what you have is in some ways a certain sense of unreality about the text, meaning that they are projecting a reality that they don't really have a bandwidth for, because they haven't done it. And what that means, literally, when you get to 1947-48, is it's like, okay, hurry up and like invent a rabbinic jurisprudence that's going to map onto this whole new scenario. So I think that also may have been behind Ben-Gurion's sense of we have the upper hand, because the point is they've been kind of preparing for this at some level, even though that's not totally true either. That's what makes this whole field, it seems to me, so interesting, to recover that first 10, 15, 20 years of these conversations about jurisprudential stuff, because the point is they all of a sudden were a state. Yeah, Larry.
And what Chuck pointed out is that we were used to being a subservient society within society, or a subservient kahila within society. Now we were going to be the dominant society, and these rules didn't work when you flipped the game board 180 degrees in a lot of these instances.
Or just remember, it's not so much they don't work. Any legal system has got to be constantly expanding. You got new problems. That's why canonical texts are always inherently limited, because they can't generate all the rules you're going to need. You're not going to have rules in 1900 for questions about things like organ donation, right? You're not going to know that's a bad example, but you know what I'm saying. I mean, think about how quickly technological knowledge is multiplying, right? So, you know, there are so many ways in which it is just utterly obvious that legal systems have to have the capacity in them for a kind of a futuristic sort of orientation that canonical systems almost always by definition lack. So, you know, norms, values, and the like. Yeah?
Well, it doesn't, just from what we read, it doesn't seem like the rabbis and the religious orthodox really ever thought that they could just basically impose a lot of as the main source of law. It seems like at least from what we read, pretty early on, you know, we can't do that. It's not practical, for example, the law about witnesses, and having so many witnesses, that's not practical. It's not practical to do that. You know, they knew that they were going to have to allow women to vote and to have these rights. So they sort of gave in on some of this stuff, and it seemed like they focused on a few strategic areas that were perhaps most important to them.
Yeah, such as?
Like marriage and things like that.
Right.
So they pulled it over, as opposed to saying, yes, we're really going to be able to take halacha and rabbinic law and
right.
make that into a legal system.
Yeah.
Or a modern.
Did everybody get that? That's a great insight that the rabbis had a sense of, look, you know what, there are certain things we'll double down on. The rest, we sort of have a sense like we're probably not going to, oh, the word I was looking for before was portfolios. Like the question of which portfolios did they want to have, these guys were not living in a cave. They had a sense of there's going to be a lot going on here. We're building a new society, a new state. There are going to be a lot of portfolios. What are the ones we really want to have our hooks into? Right, and when you think about it, when you think about what Torah Judaism is about, which are the portfolios that they would want to? I mean, you just raised this. What are the portfolios that they would want to have most access to? What is Orthodoxy based upon? Well, right,
personal status and religious observance.
Yeah, I mean, you'd sort of say the Jewy ones, right? You'd say personal status, right? You know, marriage, divorce.
Who's a Jew?
Right, who's a Jew? The conversion piece. Maybe the thing somebody mentioned, the calendar, like Shabbos and Yontif stuff. Like, what's that, you know, who's going to decide, you know, when Shabbos comes? You know, what if they had said, the way some communities do, well, you know what, Shabbos in the summertime, it's too damn late, it's always going to be 6 o'clock. You know, who gets to decide that? Andy Offit, Rabbi Berman, like, who's deciding these things? So, you know, the rabbis have a hook, in, you know, those are the things they double down on, the Jewy ones. The calendar,
education
is huge. Because, and you remember this from last year, these guys argue a lot about education. What's the language going to be? The Lithuanians might have said, hey, we would like it to still be in Yiddish. That would presume that to have the language argument would presume how much control over their educational institutions would they have? The fact that if you walk into a school in Bnei Brak, you can, or in Mea Shearim, you can still hear Yiddish. Who's running those school systems? Huh? Yeah. Yeah. Meaning they're not talking Hebrew necessarily in those schools. So the point is, education is huge in this. If you don't have control over education, it basically means that you've lost control over the formation of your own community, right? I remember many years ago, I was with a rabbi in Washington, D.C., and we were talking about, contemporary American Catholicism and the extent to which it was largely free of anti-Semitism. And he said, well, that's because after Vatican II, the textbooks changed. This is the conversation we're always having about, you know, textbooks in the Palestinian community and the extent to which Israel doesn't really control those textbooks or the production of them. I mean, you could say that about any educational system. The question is, who is writing the textbooks? After Vatican II, they started writing differently about Jews. Right, that's huge. We don't necessarily, as Jews, we don't necessarily see that because we weren't inside of those schools, but that's a huge thing. So the school system piece is a very big thing. So you're talking about stuff like Kashrut. That's the Sopranos piece of this, right? The shakedown, mafia, chief rabbi, like if you don't play ball with me, I'll take your extra kind of thing away. So Kashrut is huge. Observant stuff, personal identity, marriage, divorce, conversion, calendar, and the biggest one of all, I would say, is education. Because after all, education, you're talking about huge, huge dollars. Pardon the pun, since some of that money comes from us. Huge dollars, because, I mean, think about those of you, I mean, we've all, or most of us, you know, whatever. How much does the school system spend per annum, per kid, per capita? It's like a crazy amount, right? So you're talking a huge, huge investment. They've got to have some degree of control over education. Those are the things that they are really doubling down on. All the other stuff is like, yeah, we'd like to have a voice on those things, but these are the things that are much more central to their agenda. I missed somebody here. Yeah.
So, I mean, that's largely what they control, what they've always controlled. You know, when they're in their own little subsystem, their larger system. And that's just sticking with what they're
doing. Well, that's right. At some level, they're kind of inventing off a playbook they've already written. For sure. The big question, it seems to me, was the personal identity thing. Oh, but the other thing we left out, obviously, which in some ways is the biggest question of all, is the whole Venn diagram thing of the relationship between all the inter-Jewy stuff that they want to be interested in and the extent to which that maps onto Israeli jurisprudential questions. Like I'm sorry I didn't say that earlier, because that's ultimately the real question. In other words, are they going to be, in effect, a community within a community with their own sort of internal set of processes? Or are they, what they're really saying is, no, actually, if you want to have an Israeli passport and you want to get married in Israel, you've got to go through us. Because if they don't have that power, then it means in some ways they don't really have any power at all. Same thing with Kashrut. Same thing with all these other things. The only thing that really is not, that's not true for, is education, because you could say, well, education is just for the people in your own community. Who, in other words, the secular Jew in Tel Aviv, at some level, couldn't care less that the Haredi guy in Bnei Brak has his own school. Like, what does he care? His kid has been forced to go there. All these other things have, you go onto an El Al airplane, you're going to get kosher food, and if you sort of made some sort of stink about it, people would just say, huh? Like, they won that fight. The army is kosher. El Al is kosher. It doesn't fly on Shabbos. Right? You can't get married in Israel without a rabbi in a so-called Jewish ceremony thing. They won that fight too. These are things, so that was the ultimate question, which was, who even cares about this stuff? Will it have any social consequence? The answer is, in certain spaces in your life, it has a hell of a lot of consequence. You've got to deal with these people. Right? You want to put on a wedding party at the La Rome Hotel, or whatever they call it now, the Inbal, you got to deal with the rabbis. You can't say, "Hey, I'm bringing in some veggie caterer from Woodstock." Like, you can't do that. Yeah.
One additional thing that they get when they start participating in the state is the enforcement piece, because previously to the state, the only enforcement they had was kicking somebody out of the community temporarily. Whereas now, if they are participating in the state and if they are saying this is the only way you can get married, then the enforcement is actually by the state.
Yes.
By them.
Huge. That's a huge piece. They have the instrumentality of the state behind them. Now, of course, Ben-Gurion follows the I Ching. I'm mixing my metaphors frantically and viciously here. Ben-Gurion follows the I Ching of the Godfather. Speaking of the Sopranos, right? He says, keep your friends close, keep your enemies closer. So Ben-Gurion wants these guys far away, or he wants these guys under his thumb? Under his thumb. That goes to Vitaly's point that says ultimately the state is actually behind their authority. They're buttressing their authority. Because Ben-Gurion's thing is, I don't want you go off on your own, doing your own thing. I want there to be a chief rabbi and a kind of a rabbinic office doing stuff like administering kashrut, blah, blah, blah. How come? He wants to be able to control those people. If they're totally separate, if they are somehow extra-governmental, he's got less control. So we look at that now as, oh, it's a terrible kind of, terrible botch, because it means that religion corrupts politics and politics corrupts religion, which for sure at some level is definitely true. But the point is, he had reasons for doing it this way. He followed the Godfather, right? He didn't trust these people, and he wanted religion not to be an independent force in Israeli social life, so therefore it had to be inside the government. But of course, the huge assumption in that would be politically and otherwise, he could control them. And that was an open question. Again, in 1947, 50, 52, 55, 65, nobody was losing sleep over this stuff. Now, it's a very different story. Okay, let's take a quick look at some of these early texts, just because there are a few fun little things in here. Okay, the Rav Kook text, which is quite early. He, according to my note here, they get it wrong. It says the 1920s. They think that it was written actually in, during World War I. What is, and of course, the nice thing about using this version is they always basically summarize the version for you in the italicized introduction of the text. So, what is Rav Kook trying to do in this text? What's his larger point? What's he doing? Right, this notion of the monarchy versus a modern secular state. Yeah, Carol?
There were things that a ruler could and couldn't do, couldn't have a lot of wives or horses, you had to write a Torah, this kind of thing. So he's trying to extrapolate from what a ruler can do to now and trying to come up with something that'll work.
Yeah, and his ultimate goal is what? What's his ultimate goal in the text? Well, is that really the goal? That he wants to create a Torah state? I mean, remember, you did some Rav Kook last year. Is he a kind of a very narrow-minded, everything has got to be about religious people running everything according to religious law? What's his kind of world view around this stuff?
I think he's sort of being practical. He's saying that you can have some religious laws, but in the end, you know, you can have the ruler, as in the secular ruler, override things, and that's okay.
Yeah, the only emendation I would make to what you just said is he's practical for sure. He recognizes this is a secular society that we are building here. But what makes him, I think, interesting is the fact, the extent to which he doesn't just view that from the practical standpoint of just recognizing that, you know, it is what it is kind of thing. He also philosophically sort of supports that. This is his whole funky dialectic that says the religious and the secular are somehow working in this kind of interesting harness sort of way. In other words, he's pretty bullish on secular Zionism. He sees it as having a redemptive quality unto itself. And that's what really drives his religious part, or his co-religionists a little bit bonkers, because the whole reason why they have to write these texts is because most religious people, in theoretical terms, have no space for secularism. They can't really grasp the notion of a secular Jewish polity or society. They don't know what to do with that. Like that's a contradiction in terms to them. He is saying, in effect, I'm not losing any sleep over this, because in fact I think in much more rich, subtle ways about the dialectic between secularism and religiosity. And in fact, I think that secularism has a kind of a religious core to it, and I'm not that hung up on the fact that they are overtly secular. But you're right to say the end result in this text is to say that you don't need a monarchy, you don't need a king, you don't need a Torah, like a Torah chain of command thing that's about generating political legitimacy. That's a huge piece of this conversation, ultimately. Those of you who remember your European history know that when you had the divine right of kings, what did political legitimacy rest upon? When you had the
divine right.
Yeah. The king is appointed by God. Like, nobody's questioning the Tsar's rule or Louis XIV. Like, nobody's questioning the legitimacy of those people, because the premise is their legitimacy comes from God. That's the divine right of kings. That's the whole power of the French Revolution, to say we don't buy political right, the divine right of kings anymore. And the first great figure that kind of lives out that drama is Napoleon, because he has a sense that all the rest of the rulers of Europe think that he's this kind of grubby little Corsican who basically appointed himself. He's not appointed by God. It's a secular politics. Torah Judaism is not so different from those kings who looked at Napoleon saying, where did you get your authority from? The rabbis look at Ben-Gurion, and this is a part of the whole visiting the Chazon Ish thing. The rabbis look at Ben-Gurion and said, who appointed you? I don't see your name in the Torah. I don't see your name in the Talmud. Like, you're not plugged into that old tradition. You're some guy who organized this political party called Mapai or whatever. Like, hey, where's that in the Talmud? Where's Mapai in the Talmud? So that's a very serious thing in a political system when you've got lots of people walking around who don't fundamentally respect the legitimacy of the system. We're very spoiled in America. We don't have many wackos like that. Right? Look, think about 2000. Right? Plenty of people, at least half the people in the country, thought you had an illegitimately elected president. But you didn't have people saying, I mean, at least en masse, you didn't have people saying, hey, and because of that, I'm not going to support President Bush as the president. Like, the system held, right? Legitimacy is not something we have to worry very much about in this country. Thank God, that's a great strength of the country, right? These other kinds of places, Weimar Germany, you know, most infamously, right, societies in transition, you see that in a lot of states all over the world. Political legitimacy is always a huge issue, right? That's the whole junta thing. Right? Think about what happened in Egypt a couple of years ago. They had an election, the Muslim Brotherhood won fair and square. Huge sections of the society said, hey, I don't accept the legitimacy of the Muslim Brotherhood. I think we'll have a counter-revolution. So it's very hard to run a stable airline when you've got people saying, you know, I don't accept your rulership over me. So this whole question of the rabbis making mental space for the legitimacy of a secular government is a huge move for them, because traditionally they didn't really do that. That's a part of the subtext of all these texts. And again, that's probably why he goes to Bnei Brak to visit the Chazon Ish, which is, are you guys going to get in my way in some very overt sense? Rav Kook is saying, we're not going to get in your way. Right, I missed somebody here. Carol, did you have something you wanted to say? All right, what about the second one? This, of course, is her current Herzog. This is his grandfather. Right, the one in between. Remember, we all grew up with Chaim Herzog, the very dapper Israeli. He had many offices, very distinguished figure in Israeli public life. His father was a very well-known rabbi, very well-respected rabbi. This is page 471. Israel is a Jewish state in Jewish law. What is Rabbi Herzog? And this is sort of, I think, behind what you said about the things they double down on as opposed to the things that they sort of, kind of conceded. What are the things that he wants to hang on to? He's writing this, again, 2 months after the state. July 48, yeah?
He's just reiterating the things he already said, marriage. You know, the core principles, you know, the kashrut, marriage, divorce, Shabbat, all those sorts of things. But he's sort of finally, you see, after the Holocaust, he says, well, maybe not such a bad thing after all. And he's saying there. But he also makes the comment, I'm not really sure, but he says it's like in the early 1900s, there didn't really be such issues because all the Jews, or the majority of Jews in Israel, were observant Orthodox Jews. I don't recall that being the case.
No, totally not. Yeah, well, I mean, look, he is the one who is the most pragmatic, it seems to me. He's looking at the state of Jewry, and certainly the state of Palestinian Jewry, and what does he see, you know, socially, culturally, spiritually, demographically? Is there a kind of a demographic basis for Torah Judaism as a as a, you know, in kind of having the political critical mass to create a Torah state? No, clearly that's not happening. Does he make the same theoretical concession that Rav Kook, that says secular government is intrinsically legitimate? No. For, yeah, if you want to run a goyish country, b'vakasha. Right? You can have that. But this is, it seems to me, and I think it's great that you picked up on this, this is a much more, it seems to be, classically rabbinic kind of set of moves that he's making, which is he never formally accepts the principle, really, of secular Jewish government. It's basically almost like an emergency thing. This is what we have now. We have goyish Jews. We have people who don't cover their heads. They go to the beach on Saturday. Like, oh, you know, hey, I'm not an idiot. I'm not living in a cave. I get that. But he doesn't say we're going to somehow remake Jewish jurisprudence around what is a demographic, social, historical moment in time. That's the classic rabbinic move. The classic rabbinic move is to recognize stuff is happening on the ground. This is part of the whole famous battle in legal studies about sort of formalism versus critical realism. He's sort of saying, yeah, look, on a realistic level, I get the fact that we're living in a different Jewish world. I get the fact that we have a lot of goyish Jews. We have a goyish state. I'm going to make allowances for that. But that's not the same thing as redoing your constitution around that historical change. That's the key rabbinic move, which is you legislate for change, but you don't innovate around core principles. And that's really what he does. Right? He says the whole time, and it seems to me this document is a very good, and then we'll stand up and take a break. This document, it seems to me, is a very telling window into the traditional religious mindset, generically speaking, which is, do these people accept secularism practically? Yes. Do they accept it philosophically? Never. Never. This is the classical traditionalist religious posture, which is you don't stop your sense of commitment to things like what ultimately politically means theocratic government. You never give in on that. And that's important to recognize because you have to, you know, it's a little bit like those of us who are parents recognize, hopefully early on, children never negotiate with parents. Children are like the ultimate terrorists, right? They never negotiate. We're negotiating with them. We're moving towards them. They never move towards us. Right? So the point is, this is what it means to be a theocrat. They're not negotiating. In the here and now, they're negotiating. They want more buses, more money for their kids in school, more portfolios in the government. They're negotiating in that way all the time, but on a theoretical level, they never negotiate. They don't bargain. And that's really what Herzog is doing. What Rav Kook is much more interesting because he had a more complex theory of secularism. But if you had to ask the question, you'll get to do this much more with Jacob, you know, in effect, who wins in terms of the Kook v. Herzog view of the government moving forward? Who wins and who's the more dominant voice inside of religious Jewry in Israel today? I would say bet on Herzog. The Kook thing is too hard. It's too balanced. It's too nuanced. This idea that secularism is somehow legitimate, but Torah Judaism is too, like, what does that even mean when you get down to cases? So, all right, what questions or comments? Yeah. True.
And so it's kind of interesting to get insight into specific leaders within the community, but I don't think it's the right impression to think that
Well, for sure, that I'm sure that's true, although, of course, one of the things, I mean, it's also fair to say that, you know, there are probably divisions inside of each one of these camps, the religious Zionist camp, Agudat Yisrael, and the like. But, of course, remember, the other thing is that these communities were hierarchical in terms of their own makeup. So that even though there were for sure factions inside of them, ultimately the factionalism is mitigated by the fact that these are basically authoritarian communities, because that was the nature of rabbinic life to begin with. So that whereas we tend, by the way, that's not true just in terms of the history of Zionist politics. That's not true just of the Aguda. It's also true, for example, of the Jabotinsky community politically. Right, the Jabotinsky block, right, what becomes known, Herut, Likud, call it whatever you want, you know, was a highly autocratic community in the sense that there was a cult of personality around Jabotinsky and then Begin. So that's one of the very interesting things about Israel as a political system. In some ways, it is highly democratic, right? Lots of different groups battling with each other, but there's also a kind of an autocratic strand too inside of each one of these camps. So that, I think Ian is right to say, there are all kinds of interesting things going on inside of these communities, but ultimately you do have some way, some sense that says ultimately once they've decided sort of what they, you know, what's going to happen, there is a certain kind of marching in step kind of quality to it. So that's a kind of an interesting tension. Ian, you want to follow up, and then we'll take a few more, and then we'll take a break.
And that is something that I find very difficult to understand. That is that they were prepared to go against the petition.
They.
Meaning the religious Agudat
Yisrael,
before the status quo agreement. There was a major problem with the president's opposition to the partition plan. It's hard to understand what motivated them, because certainly the secular Jewish state is far better. I mean, they just come out of the Holocaust.
Yeah.
It's just very difficult to, for me, at this point in time, to understand what was going on in their mind.
Yeah, I think it's a great point. Anybody have a sense of like, well, okay, what possibly could have motivated them to be so agnostic, pardon the pun, about that? Yeah.
I don't think they were really prepared to go to the commission and say we don't want an Israeli state, because they knew that if they said that, there would be no Jewish immigration into Israel. I think they were just really taking this position to get something out of
it. Interesting. So that's so a horse trade. It's a tactic. Mm-hmm. Bob?
I don't think that's all of it. I think that's true in some cases. I think that my brother says you can't negotiate with people who wake up every morning wondering if the Mashiach is coming that day. And I think there is an element of that here. That people who believe, and if they believe that it's anathema to have a secular Jewish state because it's a desecration of the Torah, or it's worse, it's trying to hasten the arrival of the Mashiach, which you can't do, then they have a different thing, which is, A, we won't participate, and B, we might need to stop it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, look, I think it's on the table for that. I think, I mean, first of all, also remember, it was also on the table for people on the left, politically, not religiously. Martin Buber, the binationalist, you know, would they support a Jewish sovereign state? It was by no means a foregone conclusion. Did I miss anybody here before we take a break?
Yeah. You talked about the factionalization and the autocratic
nature of the parties, yeah. Well, that of course is one of the great what ifs. Clearly now it feels like totally, speaking of Mashiach stuff, totally impossible to sort of get the toothpaste back in the tube now. But of course a lot of people feel like it was a huge missed opportunity, although those of you who know anything about American history know that Philadelphia in 1783 was no picnic either, That's the three-fifths clause, right? Getting northerners and southerners on the same page. A lot of horse trading, very complicated, and they ended up with a very problematic document around the whole slavery piece. So it's super difficult to do it at the founding, and it just gets more so over time. At some level, you could understand the Civil War is really a kind of an ultimate collapse of that in an attempt, in effect, literally to kind of remake the country and remake the Constitution. So it's really, really hard to do that once you've kind of gotten things underway. So you sort of have to look at it like it's now or never. But yeah, absolutely. It's a huge, huge thing that they didn't do it. And when you do look at these forces and, you know, how they're arrayed against each other, it's easy to understand why he kind of walked away from it. All right, why don't we take a break, and then we'll jump into some of the more theoretical stuff. Okay. So, we didn't look at the last couple of texts. Herzl, that tiny little text of Herzl, did he want a theocracy? I mean, I think you all know the, right? But, you know, this is on 479. He says, you know, faith unites us, knowledge gives us freedom. Right? We're a religious community, but we're also a free community. That is, of course, his not-so-veiled comment, which is part of my comment response to Ian, which is he didn't like the extent to which faith communities tended towards autocracy. Right? They tended towards a certain kind of anti-intellectualism, because there was this sense of, well, you know, you have to kind of follow the leader, you have to follow the tradition. We needed to figure out a way to have a free society at the same time we were building a Jewish community. Not so easy to do that all the time. He said, and then he says in some ways the opposite of Ben-Gurion. We'll prevent any theocratic tendencies from coming to the fore on the part of our priesthood. We'll keep our priests within the confines of their temples, in the same way as we shall keep our professional army within the confines of their barracks. Right? The second thing we accept much more intuitively maybe than the first, in the sense that keeping the army in the confines of its barracks is really a way of saying, you know, you want to have civilian control over the army. At least I think that's what he's saying. But he's also saying a kind of a classical Western line, church and state should be separated. Part of what makes Israel so interesting is that they're not separated. That's Ben-Gurion's move. It says, I want them non-separated, that way I can keep them under my thumb. Yeah?
And by being sold, the numbers are so small, so can you explain...
At that time.
Why is it important? Why is it thinking
that he has to keep the numbers? That's a great question. Why does he care? Why does he want them under his thumb? That it's great that you raised that. Yeah?
They can cause
Yes, although the premise that they're small at that time would suggest that maybe
not overt political troubles, they can cause trouble in terms of what they say and who they say.
Okay, maybe. Yeah.
Potential PR.
Meaning? What does that look like?
The Jews living outside, coming, and I mean,
yeah, maybe the global Jewry piece is politically problematic. He wants to manage that set of relationships.
Birthright.
Huh?
The birthright.
Yeah, although interesting whether or not he saw that coming.
But the other thing was, by being part of the government, he had the ability to stop them from doing certain things that he didn't want them doing.
Yeah.
And he had ultimate control as prime minister if they were part of the coalition.
You know, I think for a while, it didn't. It seemed like
yes.
Everyone supported, if there wasn't any question, Israel was sort of where all the energy enforcements went. And there was just sort of everyone looking towards Israel from every corner of the Jewish world.
Well, the question, right? I
maybe
think you're.
That, maybe that was true in the, you know, the 50s and the 60s, and then maybe that changed sometime in the 70s or 80s.
Right. Well, I think we're also talking on different levels here. I think on the level of sort of the mythic level, I think that sense of magnetism, you know, sort of magnetism and people being drawn to it, I think is definitely palpable. I think you're right about that. But I also meant on a very practical level. I mean, I think he really felt like he wanted to create a new pattern. You know, would he, you know, for example, very practically, would Hebrew become the language of the Jewish people? I mean, did that happen? No.
Did he want that to happen?
Sure. No, he did. First of all, he wanted the Golah to go away. He was a classical Zionist in that kind of a way. He wanted the Golah to go away. He wanted Jews to come on Aliyah. So, what's the international language of the Jewish people? You'd have to say English, really, it seems to me. I'm not going to speak to that one. But, you know, so the point is, there's that piece, the cultural piece. Israel does ultimately not really get on top of issues of Jewish identity. The rabbis still have as much, if not more, power than ever. So this whole question of, in effect, kind of replacing the rabbis, I think, I mean, that's a much more tachlis level than what you're speaking to. It just doesn't happen. Yeah, Carol? Well, that's cultural Zionism. That's, you studied that last year.
Yeah, but it's continued.
Absolutely.
How is he the father?
No, I don't think Ben Gurion's the father of that. I think that's Achara Am, Berdichevsky.
Achara Am never got his act together to articulate.
Right.
And Ben Gurion was the practice.
Yes, but the question is ultimately, you know, is there a thriving secular Israeli culture? You bet. I think what is the question on the table for us is the staying power of that in not just cultural terms, but sort of in political terms. That's a really, I mean, we don't know the outcome of that battle yet. Right? In other words, the Cook v. Herzog thing. That still is to be decided, it seems to me. If you looked at the second Rav Cook text is, I think, a wonderful text, but, you know, the morality of holiness, because there you get a sense, even though it's in a very subtle way, and this is really an early text also, you get a very subtle critique, or not so subtle critique, of political Zionism. I don't know if you looked at this one. This is the state of Israel as the foundation of God's throne. Okay, take a look at this one. If you got the text in front of you. The state is not the supreme happiness of man. This denial is true of an ordinary state that amounts to no more than a large insurance company, where the myriad ideas that are the crown of human vitality remain hovering above, not touching it. In other words, what's Rav Cook's take on the typical secular modern state? What does it have to do with Kedusha, with holiness? Nothing. It's an insurance company, meaning what does it do?
It protects you.
It does social contract stuff. Right? Yeah, it takes your money, but it also gives you a police, it gives you this and that and the other thing. It organizes your world, it enables you to make all kinds of other moves in your private life. But fundamentally, it's a certain kind of prophylaxis. It's like a social prophylaxis. That is a kind of a critique of what sort of worldview? Written in the 1910s, 1920s. The critique of what sort of worldview that says, oh, you know what, most states are just a prophylaxis. They're an insurance company of some sort. What's it a critique of? Huh? What's it critiquing? What sort of worldviews invested a whole lot more energy in claiming, in fact, the state had a kind of an independent, surpassing, even transcendent significance?
Nationalism.
Nationalism, absolutely. And nationalism in its most nutty, crazy, scary form. Remember your Leni Riefenstahl, Triumph of the Will, right? The fascist state. I mean, of course, the Italians were, you know, less crazy than the Germans in all things, thank God. But first in fascist Italy, and then most horrifically and extremely in Nazi Germany. Right? The whole premise that the individual has no independent significance. The only significance is ultimately the state. Statism. So Cook's, there's a kind of a very wonderful, powerful, intellectual, political, theoretical conversation going on here with people who are into statism. And he's saying, you know what, statism is shallow. It's a false god. It's a kind of an idolatrous counter-theology that has no holiness whatsoever. By the way, would Ben-Gurion have agreed with this? That statism is a kind of an idolatrous thing? Sure, what's the argument for sure? Sure, he'd agree with it?
He wanted to get the Jews to the land of Israel, so just having a state wouldn't accomplish that goal. He was a cultural Zionist.
But he's really not. He's a political Zionist. Right? Is political Zionism inherently statist? And is therefore Rav Cook, in effect, critiquing in a pretty pretty strong way, the statism of political Zionism. Does everybody get why this is such an important conversation? Because ultimately, if you think there's something higher than the state, then the question is, what are you paying ultimate allegiance to? Think about how all of us were raised, right? What were we doing at 8 o'clock in the morning in any public school? Pledge of Allegiance. Right? Pretty much every single person in this room, with the exception of people who grew up in other, you know, societies, this is how we all grew up. Right? I still, you know, when I sing the national anthem at Fenway, I put my hand over, like, that's the way we were socialized. That's what you did. You said the pledge of it, like, this is the American civic religion. So, what is Cook saying here? If the state is not the ultimate, if it's not a bearer of Kedusha, so then for the Jew who takes Torah seriously, what's their ultimate allegiance? God, Torah. So then what is the political question?
How dare you?
Well, it's not necessarily how dare you, but ultimately, let's just think about it in a specific scenario. When there's a conflict between Torah and the state, what are you going to do? Torah trumps.
But he does say up here.
Yes, he does. He does. The challenge is there. Yeah, absolutely. But so I'll give you a very practical example, lest you think this is hopelessly just like a theoretical kind of coffee house conversation. When they had the withdrawal from Gaza. When they withdrew the Jewish community from Gaza, and what was that, 2007? I lost track of time now. Five, six, seven, somewhere in there? Five? Okay. So there were lots of questions in the religious community, the religious Zionist community. There was a lot of political opposition to the withdrawal. And there were many, many questions inside the religious community, and therefore the secular community was paying some degree of attention to this also. Would the religious community support the disengagement? Because the premise was that a lot of the rabbis in that community opposed it, personally, religiously, philosophically, and in some cases pretty openly in the kind of the public realm. Speaking of press, stuff. And that ultimately was a very practical question, because that meant that for kids in the service who were participating in the disengagement as a, in effect a kind of like a police force, withdrawing the Israeli civilians who were living in those communities in Gaza, those religious kids were going home on Shabbat week after week, talking to the rabbis, listening to them, you know, what are you going to tell me I ought to do? You know, I have the government on my in one ear telling me this is your job, you got to go in there, you got to take people out of their houses, etc., etc. Are you going to be telling me something in my other ear? The Torah says you should do this and not that. You should oppose the government. That was a real question for a lot of those kids and a lot of those rabbis. I happened to be in Israel earlier that summer with a group of academics, and we spent a day in Ofra, which is a community, which is a settlement community, and the rabbi who was good enough to meet with us, we asked him that question point blank. What are you going to tell the kids to do if they ask you? The kids from your community who are wearing yarmulkes, who are going to be there, what are you going to tell them to do? You're going to tell them to resist? You're going to tell them to sort of do the, you know, like the CO thing, be conscientious objectors? You're going to support it, follow the dictates of the army? Like, what are you going to do? What are you going to tell these kids? I mean, and of course, these are kids. These are like 19, 20-year-old kids. He didn't really want to answer the question. He sort of tried to duck it a little bit.
The heavy boat goes first.
Huh? Yeah, he didn't wheel that out again. But he tried to duck it. Like, I got the fact that he was sort of unenthusiastic about the question. It was a hard question for him, based upon the politics of the religious community, especially inside the shtachim, inside the territories. So I understood why he was trying to avoid it. But in the end, he answered the question. And what do you think he said? What do you think he said?
Where in the West Bank? No,
it's in the West Bank, but of course, it's near the Gush, not so far away from Jerusalem. What do you think he said in the end?
Along the land.
He said, "I'll tell them to support the government." Well, Gaza was a little bit more problematic because it wasn't like the biblical land of Israel kind of thing. So I don't, the truth is now I don't even remember exactly. I mean, I think it was a more generalized opposition to withdrawal. But, you know, the indivisibility of the land is sort of probably a kind of a general principle that has kind of emerged over time post-67. But yeah, I mean, that's what he said was, with some degree of reluctance, at least to share with us, was I support the government. Like, it's important for us not to not support the government. And I thought that was a very distinguished thing to do, given the fact that, as you're seeing in these texts, it's very complicated for people in the religious community what their kind of taxonomy, what their hierarchy of values is around the role of the state vis-a-vis Torah. It's a complicated thing. Yeah?
Do you have any insight as to how
to
reconcile that with themselves?
What do you think about that? Based upon everything you read tonight, I mean, I realize most of this stuff is sort of diagnostic in nature as opposed to from within the religious world. But based upon the text that you read, any sense of how he might have kind of squared that circle? State and Torah? Yeah?
Well, the law of the land is the land, is the law, that's law. So if truth and the Torah don't go near God, stay away from it. Get out of there.
Yeah, that's a very nice drash. I like that. Too close to the Philistines, etc., etc. Right.
40 years.
Even earlier. Right. Good. Yeah. Yeah, although I don't think that he makes that move, frankly. I mean, I think that how does How, based upon what you read, how does a rabbi end up in that place saying, look, you have to support the state? How does a rabbi do that? That's a very Machiavellian move, but that's grist for the mill, absolutely.
He's trying to protect his community and keep them alive, so he's got a community to minister to, and therefore, if he leaves them behind and something happens to them, he's out of a job, so to speak, and so running down the same track that Carol's talking about.
Yeah, maybe, yes, Bob.
So, I guess I would pose a couple of questions before that question, which is, A, how do you know he was answering honestly as opposed to answering for you? And B, wouldn't give the same answer if it was Oprah and not Gaza, not so clear. So,
true. That's so, true.
But what is clear, if he's secular enough to say our interests on the whole are better served by not being rebels right now, but that's not a God answer, that's a prayer.
Yeah.
But that would be
okay. Vitaly?
So I was thinking that, halakhically there's only three things that you're really not supposed to do. The idolatry, sexual immorality, and murder.
Yeah.
So as long as it's not one of those three things, then
you can do anything, in effect, even if you know it's breaking a commandment. That's true. Halakhically, that's true. Let's circle back to Rav Cook one last time, the one on 480. Then we have to stop in a second. But because that text has two parts. So we focused on the first and too lightly skipped over the second. He says, after he just sort of disses the modern state as being an insurance, glorified insurance company, then he says in paragraph 2, but this isn't the case regarding a state that is ideal in its foundation, in whose being is engraved the ideal content that is truly the greatest happiness of the individual. Right, meaning that the individual who is lucky enough, meaning the Jew who is lucky enough to live in a Jewish state, you can't get any better than that. It's cakes and ale all the time. Fabulous. Right, this state, he says, this state is truly supreme in the scale of happiness. And this state is our state, the state of Israel. The foundation of God's throne in the world. Its entire aim is that God be one and his name one. That's what we say at the very end of the Aleinu. Right? Adonai Echad, Ushmo Echad. For this is truly the supreme happiness. And then he goes on in a little kind of rabbinic way, Litvish way, to say, of course this sublime happiness is in need of extended elaboration. We need to figure out more exactly what that means, so as to shine in these days of darkness, i.e. like World War I. But it does not, on that account, fail to be the supreme happiness. In other words, what the rabbi of Ophrah, assuming, and he knew his Rav Cook, I can guarantee you that. Is there religious value to the state of Israel? You bet. You bet. And therefore, even though on a case-by-case level, you might say, you know what, I think the PM, the Prime Minister, is full of malarkey, I totally disagree about what he says about this, that, the other thing. The reality is the state has a meta significance. Remember, this is what you hopefully did last year. This is what it meant to be a religious Zionist in a doctrinal sense, which was the state has a positive religious value. Right, we're not statists. That's a part of the legacy, for better and worse, of being Americans. Americans are not statists. We are not, even though we quibble about Obamacare, this and that, aid to education, investing in infrastructure, blah, 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 who should be doing all that stuff. Fundamentally, the American political culture is a non-statist culture. Like, we're sort of phobic about taxes, and we're all believers in small state-ism. So this is we're a little bit tone deaf to the fact that lots of other political cultures are much more openly statist, whether it's the nationalist, the nationalist variety, or in some cases the religious variety. That's what you're reading in Rob Cook. That's a part of the energy of religious Zionism, which is, yeah, absolutely, the state has religious value. This is not an American First Amendment separation move. It's totally the opposite. And that's exactly why, to go back to what we talked about at the beginning, this is exactly why Ben-Gurion went to see the Chazon Ish. Because he wanted to get the religious community under his thumb. He wanted to harness it for his own purposes. He wanted to try to do something that, in retrospect, he sort of did, although you could argue there's a Trojan horse aspect to it, which is he wanted to get the religious community into his vision of statism, as opposed to their own vision of statism. And the question is, did he succeed? Did he get them to buy into a secular statism, or did he delude himself into thinking that's what he was doing, when in fact, what he was doing was creating a space in which ultimately their Cookian religious statism would over time reemerge? That's what you're going to spend a lot of time with Jacob on. That's the post-67 story. At the point at which Cook is talking about this, like, nobody cares what Cook is saying. Because there aren't very many religious Zionists, and there certainly aren't many Cookian religious Zionists. Right? Saying, oh, the state has a messianic significance to it. But now? That's part of what Israel is dealing with. Questions or comments? Things we did, you know, there are a lot of things we didn't talk about in the Friedman and the other reading. Things that you just found incredibly interesting that you want to share, or you want me to talk about for 2 seconds. Yeah.
The thing that always gets me is the greater Israel. You know, the boundaries that are mentioned several times, all differently, of course, in the Torah, of the land of Israel.
Yeah.
Now, I know. We'll get this later on, but is that part of the settler division? You know, Judea, Samaria.
The settlers, absolutely. If I'm understanding you properly, yeah, for sure. Yeah.
I'm just curious on. So, I mean, not if you're remembering correctly, but I think you said in the first class when you talked about the Church of Israel that, you know, why bother seeing anything related to Rav Cook or religious Zionism if it's largely or so relevant?
Yeah. Then, but not now.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm curious as to
now is super important.
But even with Ben-Gurion, I mean, was his allowances and concessions, wasn't that a key enabler? Or
look, to some extent, look, I think, right. What's the ultimate key enabler that enables the religious community to perpetuate itself? I would say, frankly. Well. I would say having a separate education system. That's huge. If they hadn't set up a separate track for the religious schools, I mean, I think you'd have a dramatically different country. You know, just the whole notion of integration would be very different. The army is the integrating institution, which is very powerful in its own right. But you can't underestimate. You know, you have in effect a kind of a state parochial school system. And by the way, and that's not true just for the national religious community. My kids went to religious schools when we lived there. You also have a Haredi school system. You also have an Arab one. You got four school systems. So when you want to talk about social cohesion, you say, on what basis would you think realistically, you could have social cohesion when you got four school systems. So I think that's huge. I mean, I think that's extremely consequential, because inside these schools, kids are being socialized in, you know, dramatically different ways, obviously, formally as well as informally.
Did Ben-Gurion push back on the status quo agreement? Was that the best he could get?
You're talking about the ultimate agreement around...
Right, the one you read.
I don't think... in other words, was he unhappy with the deal in the end?
Right.
I don't think he really cared, to be perfectly honest. I think he thought that was a perfectly reasonable deal. I think that he also... I think he felt like he had control over the things that really mattered. He didn't care about things like kashrut and personal identity stuff. He didn't see them as being that important. I mean, this goes to the issue that people raise about cultural Zionism, right? Why would he think that stuff like personal identity, marriage, divorce, conversion would not be that important vis-a-vis the larger things? I mean, that's a legitimate political determination to make. After all, most Israelis are what? They're secular. I mean, the question is: is it going to remain mostly a secular state? So, I don't think he thought it was a bad bargain. I think what he underestimated was the birth rate piece of it. You're talking about a secular state with a secular law. It's not Torah-based law. It has its own judges, courts, etc., etc. It functions as a secular state. So I don't think he thought it was a bad bargain. I think the demographic issue was an outlier for him that he clearly didn't totally see. I don't think anybody really saw it at the time.
How did the Haredim stay out of
it? Well, that's a part of that is sort of a part of the
early on. Meaning,
how did they start out on their own out of the army?
It says that at least in the Jerusalem district, they specifically didn't call them up, and there was some sense that they wouldn't have gone if they had been called up.
Right.
But as a homogenizing element, that would have been.
I agree.
Manpower element.
But also a bit. But one of the questions, and this is a question today also, is there a lot of support in the state of Israel for a universal draft that would include the Haredim in the army? What are the pros and cons of that?
Pro is they would join society.
Pro is you'd hopefully integrate them more. What's the con? Well, but not just that. I mean, what are you going to do with all these kids who don't have these skills? Like, in other words, the argument from the Haredi community, the argument for integrating them is that you'll socialize them, they'll become more Israeli. They'll also, very practically speaking, and of course this is true here too, what is the role that the army plays for working class kids? That, again, as a middle class community, we totally don't pay attention to. It's a career. It gives them skills. It's a fantastic way, hopefully, to help these kids from crappy neighborhoods, all right, very challenged neighborhoods where they really, in many ways, can't compete effectively with our kids for scarce goods and services because they don't have the tools. It gives them the beginnings of a fair fight in that regard. Same thing in Israel. So the Haredi pro-integration voice says, yeah, it's good that our kids get these skills. The argument against it from the Israeli perspective is there's too many of them, it takes too much work, and it doesn't really work that well in terms of the dynamic of the armed services. So that's a hard trade-off. When you talk to a lot of Israelis today, they're pretty unenthusiastic about a universal draft that would include every single Haredi person in the service.
Because you say they don't have the skills?
No. And therefore it takes too much work to manage them and to sort of put them in units. Like
What sort of skills are we talking about that they don't have?
Technological skills. They don't have a lot of secular education. They just, you know, they so So the unenthusiastic voice says it would take too much work to bring them into the service, and we don't want the service diverting resources into investing in them.
Are you saying the Haredi do want them to be in? I thought it was the opposite.
No, I'm saying that there. What I'm saying is there ends up being consensus in both communities that it's not such a great idea they should serve in the service.
Yet more of them serve now than any time.
Yes, more are. But what I'm saying is that plenty of people are pretty unenthusiastic about the idea that says, oh, right now we have 30%, wouldn't it be great if 70% of them were in the service? Plenty of secular Israelis do not think that is the case.
I thought that though there was an effort in Knesset to do that, and it was blocked by...
That's true, too.
Right? So it's hard for me to believe that...
Most Israelis are pretty, I would say, pretty agnostic. On the one hand, they don't like the fact that the Haredism is such a separate thing. On the other hand, they're not quite sure what to do in response to that. That's what I'm saying. Because the notion of doing it from the standpoint of using the army as a socialization tool is more complicated than it seems. Like, a kid doesn't just, you know, where are you going to stick it, a Haredi kid? Right, so it's complicated. People don't really know what to do with it. So that's the whole point. And of course, you also have this sort of sense of these trend lines that are running in different directions. This sort of, can we integrate them and assimilate them and smooth off their rough edges more quickly than they would end up, in effect, taking over our society? Like, there's a whole argument about that. Peace. Who's going to ultimately get on top of whom? That goes back to the conversation that he was having with the Chazonish. Yes, but they're growing. So, all right, let's stop here. I'll send out the things for next week. Stay warm and dry, everybody.